This is an ABC podcast.
You're listening to The Country Hour on ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill.
Hello, welcome to The Country Hour. Brooke Neindorf with you on this Wednesday afternoon. It's a beautiful day here in Port Lincoln. We're going to find out what the rest of the state is looking like shortly with the Weather Bureau. Also today, Grain Producers SA is urging a reconsideration on a proposed 30% increase on terminal access charges on containers.
When we should be encouraging our ability to get more containers through the port, and we always struggle in South Australia, of course, to get containers through here because we're sort of the end of the line. At the moment, there seems to be a bit of opportunity to export grain throughout the world, especially with the war in Ukraine, and this just looks like outrageous profiteering.
We'll have more on that story very soon. But first today, in Murray Bridge, today is the Dairy SA Central Conference, and there's about 150 dairy farmers and service providers from across SA's Fleurio, Barossa Mid-North, River and Lakes and the South East regions, and they're there to listen to a range of guest speakers. Now, topics include understanding and rethinking methane, effluent management and dairy succession planning. It's also where the national guidelines for feed pads and contained housing are being launched. We're going to hear more about that very soon. But first, one of the speakers that is there is Jake Martin, owner and president of Dairy Design Engineers, based in Florida in the United States. Good afternoon, Jake.
Good afternoon. How are you today?
Very well, thanks. So you've worked on dairy design projects in 36 countries, ranging from herd sizes from 20 to 20,000 milking cows. I guess you've seen quite a range.
Yeah, it's we will work for food.
Now, Jake, what are you speaking to dairy farmers about today?
Mostly about in housing and in trying to do the conversions from going into full grazing to bringing cattle into some type of a structure or barns and feeding them inside and housing them inside there. We've been doing this all over the world. The U.S. is heavily into housing dairy cattle. And that's what, for the most part, that's what most systems do. Here in Australia, in New Zealand, it's mostly grazing. But for various reasons, people are looking at trying to change that management strategy and go into barns. We're trying to help them to make sure they do it correctly if they want to go in that direction.
Is that mainly due to weather conditions in the different countries?
A lot of it has to do with climate because of And lately, Australia has really been hit with some pretty nasty and wet times, and cows are in mud. Cows are miserable. People are miserable. It affects milk production, and so guys are just getting tired of it and want to do something different. The barns that we've been putting in pretty much are not affected by that part. One of my dairy producers have told us it's every day that they do the same thing inside their barns. We're outside. You're constantly struggling with trying to get your management strategies correct due to weather. So it's a different way of doing business, but a lot of guys who are doing it sure like it.
What are the trends that you're seeing in intensive farming systems since you first came to Australia, and what changes have you seen?
Most of the change has been people used to do their own thing or not really look outside of their regions, and now folks are traveling a lot more. We've hosted so many people from Australia to come into the U.S. and they're looking at different things. So they're a pretty progressive group of people that we've seen. I mean, it's an outstanding dairyman in Australia, and so they're looking at different options to be able to be better at what they do and be more profitable. So it's been pretty fun.
What other trends are you seeing around the world in regards to intensive systems, feeding systems?
Mostly people are being very careful about environmental type situations. You know, it's for, whether it be for methane production or whether it be for pollution and runoff and things like that. People are being very, very wary and conscientious about that. Being good citizens, being good stewards of their cattle. I mean, it's just, especially as the farms get larger, they have to be really concerned and careful about doing those things.
Does that mean there is that a bit of a perception around intensive systems, or what are you seeing when it comes to perceptions?
Yeah, there can be a pretty negative connotation around it. Some people want to see the pretty black and white cows in the green pastures, and that's still an option, and people will still continue to do that. So it's a matter of when you start bringing cattle in the barns, it's to educating people to say that these cows are really happy campers. I mean, this isn't a barn; it's basically the Hilton. So they're bringing them into some pretty nice facilities. They have nice, comfy beds. They have fans. They have water systems. They have feed. So it's a pretty nice place to be. And if you go into a barn that's properly designed and managed, these cows are pretty happy campers.
For people that are looking at intensifying their systems and looking at this, what would be the benefit of having a master plan?
What ends up happening a lot of times, and folks will just go out and build a barn someplace or build a structure someplace, and then a little bit later they decide to do something else. Well, maybe something's in the way, and then something else is in the way. And so as farms start looking into the future, they got to have a pretty good idea of what's going to happen, where they want to go, and then make sure that the things that you do today aren't going to adversely affect things that you're going to do in the future. So we really put our crystal ball in when we work with producers to try to get a vision of where they want to be in 5 or 10 or 15 years, and it works out pretty well. But it forces people to think about the future, which sometimes it's not as easy to do.
I'm speaking with Jake Martin, owner and president of Dairy Design Engineers. He's based in Florida in the United States. Jake, what are some of the biggest differences you're seeing between what's happening in dairy here in Australia and the United States? You touched on a bit with that intensive feeding, but are there other differences as well?
Not quite as much. I mean, like I said earlier, that every one of the guys who are working with right now are coming to the States. So they're bringing back a lot of good technologies that folks in the U.S. have kept on it and making it Australian and doing their own thing. So for the most part, there's going to be a point where it's not going to be a whole lot of difference between the two systems, because cows are cows, and there's just some really good ways of doing this. And so I think that the guys here are going to put their own spin on it, but it's going to be pretty similar.
Jake Martin, you're in Murray Bridge today. What have you been able to see while you're in the region?
Just kind of working through some of the barn designs that we're doing and phasing. So going from how would you just go into a grazing facility and then build a barn, which you can do, but there's certain steps that you can take. So depending on who you are and how big your farm is and how fast you want to move, so I'm going to walk through those steps with them and just get an idea of here's the process that you could use, and of course look at some pitfalls. For each of these housing systems, there's some ways that you can really get in trouble if you're not careful. And so I'm going to try to walk through some of those things and help bring some of those things out.
Fantastic. Well, Jake Martin, thanks very much for joining us on the Country Hour today. You are going to pass over to the next guest, which is Karen Romano, who we'll speak with very shortly. That was Jake Martin, owner and president of Dairy Design Engineers, based in Florida in the United States. And he is speaking at the Dairy SA Central Conference, which is happening in Murray Bridge today. And also at this conference is where the National Guidelines for Feed Pads and Contained Housing are being launched. And to hear more about these guidelines and what they mean, we're joined by Karen Romano, National Feeding and Farm Systems Lead with Dairy Australia. Good afternoon, Karen.
Good afternoon.
Now, what are these guidelines?
So these guidelines are the first of their kind globally. They actually draw insights from international, Australian and agriculture experts, and they provide dairy farmers with the best practice approach when considering local of feeding and housing resources within Australia.
So this is the first ever, I believe?
Now, these are the second edition guidelines. The first edition guidelines were written by Scott McDonald and were only Victorian-based, and they only addressed feed pads and freestalls, because at that stage we only saw three freestalls in the horizon back in 2010. Now, in 2023, we've actually got 161 different types of contained housing systems underway in Australia. Operating environment has changed, and so we've actually taken the opportunity to expand the guidelines beyond Victoria to a national footprint, and also invite global subject matter experts to actually share their experiences, which we can Australianise for our Australian farming conditions.
As was, that was going to be my next question. It was designed and looking at local Australian conditions and regulations, but you did approach a lot of people worldwide looking at global best practice. How did it go about getting that information to put these guidelines together?
Yeah, great question, because as you know, and as I've indicated in my earlier response, that Australia is fairly new into this space. We've seen quite a bit of development within Victoria and now emerging in other states. But the US, United States, has been at the forefront in this space for a number of years. And we have specialists. For example, you spoke to Jake Martin earlier, who's an agricultural engineer, has been working in this space for over 30 years. And so they're the type of people that we tapped on the shoulder to say, can you actually make a contribution to these guidelines? In addition, another expert from internationally was well-known researcher Nigel Cook from Wisconsin Madison University. He's written considerable papers about the welfare and bedding and the management of contained housing systems. And so his contribution to this document is really strengthened those chapters within the resort.
How many dairy farmers would be looking at contained housing or using it?
Great question. So probably 4 or 5 years ago, well, as I mentioned, in 2010, we only had 3 free stalls in Australia. Now, currently, Scott McDonald through Agriculture Victoria has been working with about 161 different operations, ranging from dairy dry lot, loose housing, which is a compost bedded pack barn or deep litter barn, and then also with free stalls. So we're seeing an increasing trend and interest in this space. And I actually believe that this will continue given the volatile operating environment some farmers are facing. So we look at the floods that are occurring in New South Wales in the Murray Dairy region and more recently the end of the Murray in South Australia where I am now. These changed operating environments are causing farmers to rethink their farm systems and work out, well, how can I introduce feeding and housing infrastructure to mitigate some of these issues that are affecting the way I farm?
Did you have to change the guidelines at all, Karen, with all these floods that you are seeing and the issues that dairy farmers have been facing?
Not necessarily change the guidelines, but look at how we can put those in the forefront of some of farmers in those areas to consider. But one of the insights that did come out, particularly in some regions, was thinking about the location of feed resources on farm, which can be considerable, and having those feeding kitchens and resources stored above the flood line. So we've had examples of some systems within the Murray Dairy region and also in the New South Wales coast where fodder or forage supplies were lost due to flood waters or other conditions. And so that should be in the forefront of mind. Not only are we trying to build these feed structures and housing infrastructures in a space where they're above the flood line, but also the feed resources associated with those systems as well.
I'm speaking with Karen Romano from Dairy Australia. Just finally, Karen, these guidelines, are they relevant to all dairy farmers?
Absolutely. So they actually cover grazing systems which incorporate feeding infrastructure such as basic feed pads, concrete feed pads or roofed housing facilities such as Australian cow homes. And then they also relate to farmers considering intensifying their farm business, shifting away from grazing to a zero grazing system where cows are fed a TMR ration. And so that's relevant in that space is dairy dry lot, our loose housing facilities and free stalls. So we actually, because they're national, they hold relevance to our entire industry and should be seen as a go-to resource when you're considering making any changes to your farm system with those types of infrastructure in mind.
Well, Karen Romano, thanks very much for your time today on the Country. I'll let you get back to the dairy farmers that are there in the room. I really appreciate your time, and those guidelines will be out being launched today, but dairy farmers can have access to them soon.
Yeah, absolutely. You can access those on the Dairy Australia website. They've been made live today, so absolutely available to farmers. We want them to have a look at it, and industry personnel as well.
Fantastic. Thanks very much for your time today, Karen.
Okay, thank you.
Karen Romano, National Feeding and Farm Systems Lead with Dairy Australia. So, yeah, some interesting stuff happening at the Dairy SA Conference. We'll move away from that now, and we're going to meet a lady called Sue McCluskey. She's a New South Wales cattle farmer who sits on the boards of Live Corp, the Australian Pork Research Institute, the Australian Wool Network and Australian Unity. And despite already donning plenty of hats, she's chucked another one on as the first special representative for Australian agriculture. Lucy Cooper caught up with Sue at the Pacific Agriculture Conference in Fiji to learn about what a special representative role actually entails.
Well, my role as special representative is really about market access and trade, and certainly reform in those areas. And so what I do is really give the message on a global stage, firstly about what we do in Australia, so other countries actually know what we're doing, and particularly when it comes to things such as sustainability and the sort of measures we do. I always say, as a farmer, I know, I look after my land, I look after my environment, because if I don't, it won't be there for the next generation. So I think there's some important messages that we need to keep reiterating in our global markets. But it's also to be able to give the message that one size doesn't fit all. So we're fully committed to the rules-based system and the organisations that actually underpin them, like the WTO, the FAO and others. But there's not one set of standards that fit for everyone. So it's really about taking a principles or outcomes-based approach to say, actually, we're all on the same side here, but how we get there may be a bit different depending on our production systems, our environment, our climate, and the way we farm. So that's a very important message I give.
That was Sue McCluskey. She's a special representative for Australian agriculture. She was speaking there with Lucy Cooper in a very, very noisy Fiji. Brooke Neindorf with you. This is The Country Hour. It's 22 minutes past 12.
Simone Young is one of the most talented conductors of her generation.
When I started, I faced considerable opposition.
Executive producer Kate Blanchett takes us into the world of one of our greatest conductors.
In 1991, there were no women conductors.
What does being a woman have to do with conducting?
She's not afraid to just be a boss.
Simone Young.
She was born to be a conductor.
Knowing the score.
It is magic.
Streaming now on ABC iView.
You're listening to The Country Hour on ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill.
Let's head to the markets now with John Trager. Good afternoon, John.
Good afternoon. Quality was again extremely mixed, with Merino lambs again making up the bulk of the offering, as agents presented 4,200 lambs and 2,200 sheep. Competition was fair to good, with restockers more active on a better selection of suitable lambs. Prices eased in the earlier sales but firmed as things progressed. Mutton quality was again good and prices here remained firm. Extremely light lambs sold from $64 to $100, as light lambs range from $100 to $116. Medium weights sold from $140 to $162, as heavyweights range from $180 to $190, with extreme heavyweights topping at $214 per head. Hoggets sold from $86 to $126, with light to medium weight mutton selling from $74 to $80, as heavyweights range from $65 to $106. Ram lambs sold from $71 to $114 per head. Meanwhile, in the cattle market, quality improved this week as agents offered 200 live weight and open auction cattle, along with 75 open auction calves. Competition also improved this week as the market sold to a stronger trend for all classes. Light and medium velar steers sold to $3.52, with heavyweights selling from $3.52 to a sale top of $6.15 a kilo. Light and medium weight velar heifers sold from $3.00 to $3.62, with heavyweights selling from $3.64 to $3.80 a kilo. Light yielding steers sold from $3.48 to $3.70. Medium weights range from $3.36 to $4.02, with heavyweights selling from $3.54 to $3.76 a kilo. Medium weight yielding heifers sold from $3.26 to $3.64, with heavyweights ranging from $3.52 to $3.62. Heavy cows sold from 260 to 276 cents, with heavy bulls selling to 262 cents a kilo. This is John Traeger at the South Australian Livestock Exchange for MLA's National Livestock Reporting Service and the Country Hour.
Thanks, John. Let's go to Mount Gambier now. We're joined by Peter Kerr. Good afternoon, Peter.
Good afternoon, Brooke. This is the Mount Gambier Cattle Report for the 22nd of March. Numbers climbed a little as ACE sold 369 head of live weight and open auction cattle. These sold to a smaller field of trade and processor buyers with no feeder interest in the offering, while restockers took the opportunity to turn cattle back out to the paddock. Quality was mixed at best in a much cheaper market. Feeders ranged from 294 to 346 cents for both sexes, as yearling steers to the trade made from 235 to 370 cents a kilogram. Restockers turned yearling steers back out from 270 to 320, with yearling heifers attracting the trade from 240 to 380 as yearlings lost 20 to 50 cents a kilogram, with more in places. Growing steers and bullocks were small in number. They made from 340 to 352 cents to trade buyers, with a fall of 17 cents, as growing heifers also did the trade, made from 260 to 340, while manufacturing steers sold from 275 to 310 cents a kilogram. Heavy cows returned from 250 to 300 cents to lose 12 cents. Lighter lots made from 200 to 275, with a small offering of bulls ranging from 210 to 250 cents a kilogram. This has been Peter Kerr for the MLA's National Livestock Reporting Service.
Thanks very much, Peter. Let's head to the Weather Bureau now. We're joined by Simon Timke. Good afternoon, Simon.
Hello, Brooke.
Another warm one across the state, or is it just Port Lincoln today?
Look, not overly hot, and most places are sort of across the south are near average temperature for this time of year, but it is still pretty hot across the north and the west of the state, and that those sort of higher temperatures are expected to last for a few days. Further south, though, we're in a south to southeasterly airstream around a ridge of high pressure to the south. It's produced a little bit of fog about the southeast districts earlier this morning, and some low cloud about Eyre Peninsula and the West Coast district, which is slowly clearing away now that the sun's warming things up. But generally speaking, fairly stable conditions under that ridge and the upper trough, and most of the cloud that produced some showers and thunderstorms yesterday moved over the eastern states now. So for most of South Australia today, dry conditions, just a slight chance of a shower or thunderstorm up in the far northeast, where there's a slow moving trough which is sort of persist up that part of the state for the next couple of days, eventually moving to the east during Friday. A similar day on the way for Thursday, although temperatures a little bit lower. Most places across the south a little bit below average tomorrow. But as I said earlier, staying hot in the north and west, hot to very hot even. Dry conditions for most of the state again tomorrow, apart from a little bit of patchy fog to start off with about the southern agricultural area and maybe a light shower near southern and western coasts. A similar again on Friday, things not changing too much late in the week. Chance of a bit of cloud developing in the west and a possible shower about the west coast district, but mostly dry everywhere else. And then things change a little bit on Saturday. We start to see a trough moving over the southeastern part of Western Australia, moving into SA on Saturday, bringing a bit of cloud to the west and a chance of a shower or two about western districts. That trough extending eastwards on Sunday, bringing some showers over western and southern parts of the state, and then those showers continuing through the early part of next week. It's a bit of a different signal coming from the different models that we look at for early next week, so a bit of uncertainty and therefore lower confidence with exactly the timing of those showers and where they're going to be, but certainly some potential over most districts for showers early next week. As far as rainfall totals go for that four-day period out to the end of Sunday, generally less than 2 millimetres, I think, over the agricultural area, western districts and the far northeast. But we could see some local falls of 2 to 10 millimetres about the agricultural area and in the west, Brooke.
Fantastic. Thanks very much for your time this afternoon, Simon.
Thanks, Brooke.
Simon Timke at the Weather Bureau. Let's look at the Western Inlands for tomorrow. For the Upper Western, mostly sunny. A medium chance of showers in the southeast in the afternoon and evening. Near zero chance of rain elsewhere. Chance of a thunderstorm in the afternoon and evening. Overnight temperatures falling to 20 to 25, with daytime temperatures reaching the mid to high 30s. For the Lower Western, mostly sunny, medium chance of showers in the far east in the afternoon and early evening, near zero chance of rain elsewhere, also a chance of a thunderstorm in the northeast in the morning and afternoon. Overnight temps between 17 and 22, daytime temps reaching the low to high 30s. It's 12:30.
You're listening to The Country Hour. For more stories from across the country, go to abc.net.au/rural. On ABC Radio Adelaide, South Australia and Broken Hill, this is Brooke Neindorf. Brooke Neindorf.
Hello, thanks very much for your company on this Wednesday. Coming up over the next half an hour, there are many industries that are struggling to fill their workforce, including the trucking industry. But a new national program called Foot in the Door will aim to get more women in the driver's seat. But the experience line is the biggest hurdle that they're often faced with.
There are a lot of women out there who've gone out, paid for their own heavy vehicle licences and then wandered around in a wasteland on their own trying to find work and are asked constantly to come back when they have 3 years' experience.
We'll have more on that story shortly, but we'd love to hear from you. Are you seeing more female truckies on the road? I know that I definitely am. You do see them here and there, which is fantastic to see. You can send me a text on 0467 922 891. We're going to head to the newsroom now. We're joined by Matt Coleman. Good afternoon, Matt.
Hello, Brooke. In the news this afternoon, a student is in hospital fighting for life and another is in a serious condition after being hit by a truck at a pedestrian crossing outside the Marriottville High School in Adelaide's eastern suburbs this morning. The pair was struck on Kensington Road just after 8 o'clock. The 16-year-old boy and 16-year-old girl were taken to the Royal Adelaide Hospital. The 59-year-old truck driver was not injured. A cyclist is in a critical condition in hospital after crashing at Darlington in Adelaide's southern suburbs this morning. It happened just after 6:30 on Flagstaff Road. The 57-year-old male rider was rushed to the Flinders Medical Centre. And the state's planning minister, Nick Champion, is asking councils to look at the land they hold and to release some to allow for more housing development. Nick Champion has written to all councils urging them to strategically plan, as well as looking at local traffic issues and utilising heritage laws. More news at 1 o'clock.
Thanks very much, Matt. Matt Coleman in the newsroom. Brooke Neindorf with you, and we're going to go to ports and costs here. And Grain Producers SA is urging a reconsideration on a proposed 30% increase on the Terminal Access Charge, the TAC, on containers. As of 1st of April, at Flinders Adelaide Container Terminal, which is owned and operated by Flinders Port Holdings, a TAC of $103.50 will be applied to full export containers, and a TAC of $146.50 will be applied to full import containers. But Grain Producers SA Chair Adrian McCabe says that producers are already hurting with record high input costs, and it's disappointing to see container costs rise as well. And he says they didn't see such a big jump coming.
No, we didn't. It was unusual, right? Like it was a 30% charge sort of hidden away in the middle of a big harvest set for April 1. So, no, sneaking it in there amongst big announcements about submarines, I think.
So what are your biggest concerns with this increase?
Well, it's a 30% increase. When we should be encouraging our ability to get more containers through the port. The cost of containers is outrageous at the moment, the profiteering by those companies, and also now the handling of them has jumped 30%. Now, we always struggle in South Australia, of course, to get containers through here because we're sort of the end of the line. At the moment, there seems to be a bit of opportunity to export grain throughout the world, especially with the war in Ukraine, and this just looks like outrageous profiteering on the back of, you know, sneaking it through whilst there's some high prices around.
So this cost, that does get passed on to producers. How do they pay that?
Well, it basically reduces their ability price per tonne. So it becomes the price that companies are able to execute contracts to deliver grain around the rest of the world, which is really needed, as we know. There's been 20 million tonne wiped off the world export market with the war in Ukraine. The world needs grain to be put on ships and travelled around the world. And some companies require it in boxes or containers, as we say. And then there's also the developing market for legumes and things that really like them in smaller containers that suit those markets. So at the moment, it just puts the containers out of reach to compete against the bulk export market.
So, Adrian, are these containers by producers here in South Australia, are they only using export containers, or would this impact them with the increase in full import containers as well?
So this is food-grade containers that come here to deliver, to take food quality back out of South Australia. So some of these containers are actually, as I understand, even dead-ended into South Australia to be turned around, because we don't really have an import capacity for a lot of containers, but we do require containers to leave. So containers are problematic for us anyway, and this really looks a bit of a push by Flinders Port to test the resolve of the new government in trying to limit their cost of exports.
Have you heard from Flinders Ports about why these charges have been increased?
Yeah, we did. We wrote to them and they said, basically, thanks for the letter. Too bad we're doing it. That was about the extent of the letter. So no, we didn't get any. It was a pretty poor response, really.
You said there about the rising input costs and the growers being hit by these. A lot of industries are being hit by increases in products and what they're doing as part of their business. Can you see that maybe this is an increase in cost because they've also got an increase in cost of what they're doing?
30%? No, I don't think so. And plus the ability, they've got the ability to actually increase their volume to help cover the inputs and input costs. We've had a good harvest here in South Australia. If containers were actually more achievable and cheaper to use, we'd put more through there. That's pretty simple economics, really. They've got the opportunity to, all companies involved in the container market and food-grade container market, to actually increase supply and increase throughput. And surely that's what Flinders Port should be. But this is going exactly against that.
Have you spoken to farmers about this already, Adrian?
Well, we've really just been alerted to it, and obviously this is why we put out a press release, and I'd be interested to know a response from government also, that a monopoly like Flinders Corp can just do this, and how we oversight that, and how a 30% increase can be justified.
Grain Producers SA Chair Adrian McCabe, and we have put a call into Flinders Ports as well for their response. They weren't available today, but we'll have them on the Country Hour tomorrow. It's 24 minutes to one.
This is ABC Radio Adelaide, South Australia and Broken Hill.
Now, this is a story that we've been following since Friday out of Menindee, with millions of fish dead in the Darling River. Yesterday, furious Menindee local residents vented their frustrations at a community meeting, which was organised by government officials. One resident challenged the panel to drink the water coming out of the river, the water that is pumped into their homes.
OK, I'll put this to a challenge. Would you fellas sitting at the table, and you drink a glass of water at the taps? I just want to know, will you all do it?
This isn't coffee.
Can I get some young ones here to go and get down the kitchen there and get 10 cups of water for us?
Yeah, look, yeah. This isn't coffee, it's water.
No, I want everyone. If this water's good enough to be given our kids and our old people, I want to see it.
So that was one of the attendees yesterday at the Menindee meeting. And after a similar mass fish kill event only a few years ago, many have expressed a sense of feeling of being abandoned and ignored. The lack of local representation in decision-making positions within the emergency team, which includes police and government officials, was also a source of contention. Assistant Commissioner Brett Greentree is leading the Emergency Operations Centre, and Amy Volkovsky spoke with him about the meeting and what's next and people's concerns.
Yeah, that was really important. So that was police-led, but well supported by other agencies. You know, I think I said the other day, it's so important that we've just got to over-communicate. And that to me, is about transparency and being upfront with the community, what we can do, why we're doing it, and how long things take. So, I spoke to my local police commander who led that, and the local emergency operations controller, and they told me, there was certainly some frustration and, emotion. It is so important for people to be able to express that and to talk about it and ask questions. So, I hope to have another follow-up one. I think they're really important. And, look, again, the community of Menindee have been through a lot. We really need to acknowledge that, and that is not lost on me. Hence the reason we just need to be you know, totally upfront and honest and get about the job and resolve this as quick as we can. But really important meeting.
Now, as you said, you do have officers on the ground there communicating with the local community, hearing their concerns. What are you hearing back from them? Are the major concerns in the community at the moment?
Yeah, the concerns are still, and I hope to be on the ground there in the next day or so, which is really important. But, you know, from the daily meetings I have with the officers on the ground, I'm hearing, you know, frustration, concern, and certainly some scepticism about the water. I understand that, about the water quality, but, you know, I can reassure, again, the community, New South Wales Health and Water New South Wales, and essential water. That's been monitored by the, you know, the treatment plant water is of high quality. You know, I say that again, that's really important, that message. So that's a concern. I understand that, and the smell from the river and the, you know, the decaying fish, and also, you know, how we're going to dispose of them. So it's important there's action on the ground today. I know there's been a couple of days, but right from the very beginning, I said we needed specialist contractors. You know, we've engaged one, looking at another. We've also got fire and rescue involved to assist with the booms and moving fish towards the edge of the river so we can try and clean them out. It's challenging, you know, but as long as we're up front and tell people that, that's why it's been difficult. We couldn't get commercial contractors there on Monday, otherwise I would have had them there. But they're there today and we're going to do our best. And again, will we remove every fish? I highly doubt it. There's millions, but we will do our best and focus on the priority areas around town and those high density areas, which is important. So it'll be really nice, I think, for the community to see action. So in terms of community concerns, I'm still about the water. I understand that. But again, I reiterate the high quality of water that is being tested and monitored 24/7. And those that are on the river water, which is different, of course, and that is a concern, we have potable water there supplied by the council. So water concerns and the disposal of fish, you know, are the two major things I'm hearing from the ground.
Now, while things like water quality and the fish, as you said, are the most pressing concerns, I understand at the meeting there are a lot of frustrations being expressed about the bigger long-term situation, what has and hasn't been done so far. Will these emergency meetings continue to give opportunity to air those concerns and ask those questions, or are they really just about the immediate emergency?
Yeah, look, that's a really good point, and you are right. That is another area. I certainly don't want to, you know, dismiss environmental concerns and ongoing issues with the water system, but you're not really in a place, and I've said from the beginning, I'm not a fish expert, I'm not a water expert, but I do understand there are some environmental and some legacy issues there. So I guess our role and my role, and again, not being dismissive at all of those concerns because they're really genuine, but from an emergency operations control perspective, like we'll keep the operation open in order to, our two objectives are always about the water quality and the disposal of the fish. And we'll keep the operations centre open until we get that done. In terms of the longer term issues, and I understand the concerns there, that is probably for another agency. Again, not being dismissive, probably for another agency.
Assistant Commissioner Brett Greentree is leading the Emergency Operations Centre in Menindee and speaking with Amy Volkovsky. Now, residents are saying that all they really want to know is why their beloved Darling River has turned so deadly. Cameron Lay is the Director of Freshwater Environment at DPI Fisheries and was on the river yesterday. And as the clean-up operation commences, Mr. Lay said those on the ground need to be listened to.
Well, it's a really important opportunity for the community to both hear our perspective, but more importantly for us to, you know, hear both the frustrations and the opinions of the local community. Obviously, if we can provide the information as we understand it, but we certainly don't discount, you know, the significant importance of local knowledge. It was a fantastic opportunity for us to not only bring our perspective about what's happened over the last few weeks, but to hear some really, you know, heartfelt and really informed opinions from members of the public. I'm pretty emotional about fish. I've been working with them for 25 years, but these are people who live on a river and they've lived it their entire life. We really welcome that level of passion and emotion, and then hopefully out of that we get better management decisions going forward. Contractors arriving in town today and also from tomorrow morning, so we've got the Rural Fire Service, Fire and Rescue, sorry, providing some booms. There's some trucks and some excavators that should be here either late this afternoon or tomorrow morning. And then there's some licensed commercial fishers who are going to assist with the removal of the carcasses. So that should be well underway either late this afternoon or early tomorrow morning. Obviously, there's huge numbers of fish that have perished over the last 3 to 4 days. We'll be doing everything we can to remove as many of those we can, primarily around the town water offtake, to try and reduce both the impact on town water supply, but also just on the amenity for local communities. You know, the smell and the visual impact, it's really not a pleasant sight. So anything we can do to improve that will be of benefit to the community.
Cameron Lay, Director of Freshwater Environments at DPI Fisheries. He was at the town meeting in Menindee yesterday. He was speaking there with Oliver Brown. And in relation to the water that's being pumped into the town, an essential water representative said the independent tests on the water in the past week had detected no abnormalities to make it unsafe to drink. And an Environment Protection Authority representative said extra water samples would be flown to Sydney to be tested for heavy metals and pesticides. And you can keep up to date on this story online, abc.net.au/news. And also if you head to the ABC Broken Hill Facebook page, there's some great photos in terms of what they're seeing, that the team there at Broken Hill are seeing on the ground in Menindee. So make sure you jump online and check those out as well. Brooke Neindorf with you. It's 12:15.
Join Aaron Bryans, Andrew Capel and Dean Brogan Saturdays at 11 for SA Grandstand.
When you look back at it, Dean, when you play, do you think you took it seriously enough?
From a player's point of view, no. I'm sure the doctors did. I think the two times I got concussed or knocked out, I was back out there playing because I wanted to. And now with all the science involved and all the medical people involved, we know what it does to people now.
ABC Radio and ABC Listen, your home of the AFL.
This is ABC Radio Adelaide, South Australia and Broken Hill.
Now, the Forestry Centre of Excellence in the Limestone Coast is one step closer, with the state government launching the centre's strategic plan yesterday. The $15 million project will be built in Mount Gambier and serve as a hub for forestry management and training in the Green Triangle, collaborating with industry and education providers. Primary Industries Minister Claire Scriven says the plan will help guarantee research and planning for local forestry for years to come.
Look, this is certainly about addressing barriers, but it's also really about realising opportunities. Before the state election last year, we announced that we would be investing $15 million into a 10-year collaborative project, which really will lay the vision for the future of our forestry sector. So Forestry Centre for Excellence is the outcome of that election commitment that we're now delivering on. And our region has had 140 years of expertise in forestry in terms of skills and knowledge and experience. And that increases our workforce capability and employment opportunities. So the release of this strategic plan is really about enhancing the capability for the Forestry Centre for Excellence to deliver better economic prosperity, generate more jobs, more investment. Some of the barriers are around things like the need for new and innovative products to have a strong and wide acceptance across our industry. And that's some of the things that we will be looking at. But in terms of the forest research priorities, that includes water, includes fire, tree breeding, the wood products that I mentioned, things like data analytics, carbon and its future, silver culture and environmental management.
One of the areas that's addressed is the communication and almost advertisement of the Southeast forestry as a region. Is it something that was identified that perhaps the region doesn't do the best job of putting itself out there in the world forestry sphere?
Yeah, so the Limestone Coast does certainly have recognition in terms of its research, but we want to be able to capitalise on that even more. So the centre has a vision to be really recognised internationally in forest industries research, as well as in that product and market development. So we've already been doing a lot of it. What we want to be able to do is even more, and that will bring increased benefits to the region as well as to the industry.
And sustainability-wise, what sort of research and work will the centre be doing in terms of sustainability, which with the IPCC report today is such a big thing for the industry to be looking at?
Yeah, so we know that forestry has an amazing opportunity to contribute to our environmental credentials. We know we're heading towards net zero targets both as a state and also as a nation. And because trees sequester carbon and they stay sequestered even after the trees have been harvested and made into other products, it's a really excellent opportunity in terms of harnessing that and making sure that it continues to develop and contribute to our net zero targets and to improving our environment.
Where do you think the Centre of Excellence can be in the next 10 to 15 years as it works through this plan?
Well, I think the real benefit of our $15 million investment over this 10 years is that it does give some certainty for research going forward. It's really important in terms of, for example, appointing a global specialist in terms of perhaps the centre director, and also making sure that we do have the opportunities to offer long-term research positions.
Primary Industries Minister Claire Scriven. The University of South Australia already undertakes extensive forestry research within the Green Triangle and will be one of the partners in the new centre. Deputy Vice-Chancellor of Research and Enterprise at the UniSA, Professor Marnie Hughes-Warrington, says the centre will help with collaboration in the industry.
Look, the thing I really love about this centre is that this is really from the ground up, and this is the region speaking to what excellence is. They've been very clear about what they need. They need collaboration, which has been building significantly across the decade. But they're now looking for the next generation of skills. So when you go to Mount Gambier, the thing I love about it is you hop off the bus, you talk to people in industry, and they say, hey, we need people with training in machine learning. We need people with training in data analytics. People have got a very, very, very clear idea of the skills that are needed for the next generation of forestry, because they've got that collaboration up and running already. So they've got a very focused view on the skills, and they've got a really clear view about how they need to work together to get this to happen. So this is a really exciting centre for that reason.
Yeah. How long do you feel the centre has to train for that next generation, or is the next generation of forestry already here?
The next generation's already here. It's remarkable in the region. You see people using LiDAR, you see people using drones, you see people using data analytics. You go to a sawmill and people are using AI and data analytics to identify how to mill logs in ways that follow the curve of the logs, really, really smart, and minimise waste. You see people using, surface radar to identify which trees to harvest and which ones not to harvest. So the technology's already here. Great technology also about monitoring worker fatigue. So there's just a sense of people working with the technology in ways that really advance what the community wants to do. It's not the technology telling the community what to do, it's the community having harnessed the technology. So that generation's already here, and this really is just about this acceleration, actually putting the pedal to the metal and accelerating this real powerful collaboration.
University of South Australia's Professor Marnie Hughes-Warrington speaking with Sam Bradbrook about the Forestry Centre of Excellence in the Limestone Coast, which is now one step closer with the announcement of a $15 million project that we built in Mount Gambier. Brooke Neindorf with you, and now we're going to head on the road. There are many industries that are struggling to fill their workforce, including the trucking industry. And although there's plenty of people with their heavy vehicle licences, they're being turned away due to a lack of experience. But next month, the new national program called Foot in the Door will launch, aiming to get more women in the driver's seat. Lyndall Denny, CEO of Women in Trucking Australia, says the program will be the first and largest single female recruitment of heavy vehicle drivers in Australia's history.
There are a lot of women out there who've gone out, paid for their own heavy vehicle licences, and then wandered around in a wasteland on their own trying to find work, and are asked constantly to come back when they have 3 years experience. So Women in Trucking Australia was set up to support those women and other women interested in beginning a trucking career to actually get a foot in the door.
Lyndall Denny believes that gender bias continues to be a major defining barrier for women seeking a career in trucking. Additionally, women are good at underselling themselves.
It's a male-dominated sector, and I guess that unconscious bias where we pick like for like means that, the men will normally get a run before us girls do. Men also tend to oversell their skills, and women are the exact opposite.
So, how will the new Foot in the Door program bridge the licence to employment gap?
The Women in Trucking Australia board and myself are all working female heavy vehicle drivers, so we know what women want when it comes to trucking careers. We'll be assessing those women and then working with employers in those women's own local area and supporting them with this Commonwealth funding that comes through the National Heavy Vehicle Regulator, working with employers and trainers to get them in those trucks and out on the nation's roads. And the only way they can get experience is on the job. But nobody or very few people are training drivers from the ground up. So we just need to change that, you know, a bit of a cultural shift and get the industry to look again at attitude. Attitude is critical when you're driving a heavy vehicle. So you can teach anybody to drive a truck, but you cannot teach someone to have a good attitude.
Although the Foot in the Door pilot program is only for those who already have their trucking license, Lyndall Denny hopes that in time it will be offered for those who don't, and also those people seeking employment.
We have had the department approach us wanting to work with us to get unemployed people up into trucks. We said no for this first iteration, but those unemployed people, you know, are welcome to approach us, and we would be delighted to work with them in the second iteration later on in the year and get them up into heavy vehicles as well.
Lyndall Denny, CEO of Women in Trucking Australia. Western Australian truck driver Heather Jones is the owner of Pilbara Heavy Haulage Girls, which is a rare company training women to drive trucks. She says there's not only a gap from licence to employment, but also in the skills being taught when acquiring those licences.
It is really difficult because when you get your licence, you're taught how to drive a truck forwards, backwards, connect, disconnect, and really basic stuff. You're not taught about the load or any of the trailers behind. And each different occupation requires different trailers, like side tippers or end tippers for grain and a whole lot of other things, general freight. It requires separate training. So that's the shortfall between getting your licence and actually knowing what you're doing.
Heather Jones says that the industry needs more financial support and that the little money that is being thrown the industry's way needs to be redirected.
I think it's because there's no funding to actually help people in the industry to get that. Well, there is funding, but it's not designed to what the industry needs. The funding that's needed is companies need to actually have a little bit of help in wages to put on new people, perhaps 2 or 3 months of wages so that they can do their pre-apprenticeship. Our training school is funded by ourselves. We have a real transport company and we fund the new drivers. A couple of them, if they're in a position to pay, do pay. But at the end of that, we've got a 95% retention rate when we do place our students and a 98% success rate that those students get a job within 2 weeks from leaving our training school.
So, with so many women keen and the pilot program almost ready to launch, surely women will be desirable employees, right? Well, Heather explains why that may not be the case.
We're 51% of the population and only 2.5% of the transport industry on-road driving. So women won't just jump behind a wheel. If you're given a set of keys, here's your truck and off you go. We want to know where we're going, how long it's going to take, what if this happens, and going to have 3 phone numbers just in case Bill doesn't answer. I want Bob and John as well. And I think that puts a lot of people off. Because say they can train a bloke in a week, but it might take 3 weeks for the female to be confident to go by herself. But you'll find that female won't do the damage that person that you've given a week to will.
So where did it all go wrong? And just how bad is the truck driving labour shortage at the moment?
Because when you get your licence, you're not job ready. And I think that we've been failing newly licensed drivers, male and female, for a very long time. Australia has a serious situation at the moment. We don't have enough truck drivers. The answer isn't bringing overseas drivers in. It might be a short stopgap measure, but that's not the answer. We have hundreds and hundreds of people who want to come and do our training. So we do know that in Australia, we do have enough truck drivers to fill the seats. It's just finding them and training them so we can put them in the seats out on the highways.
Western Australian truck driver and owner of Pilbara Heavy Haulage Girls, Heather Jones. Kasharina Smith is a South Australian fuel tank driver and believes getting young people in the industry is the key to tackling labour shortage. She currently has almost 14,000 followers on her Instagram, where she uses the platform to highlight working in the trucking industry.
So basically my goal is to try and encourage others to get in the industry and have a bit of a behind the scenes view of what it's like day to day as a truck driver. And then I wanted to create a safe space that people can come to me with questions that they may have otherwise been too embarrassed or shy to ask. It's turned out to be becoming quite a community, and eventually I want to create educational videos that people who do and don't drive can find informative. And then eventually, hopefully through this, I can then get into schools to start talking to kids about truck safety and awareness. And then that might inspire them to realise that there are actually career options in this industry as well.
So, once she's got her foot in schools, how does Kasharina see the program working?
I kind of want to get into schools and go to career expos and talk to kids about career opportunities in the industry. So I kind of think that if a young kid could start off like any apprenticeship where they learn, you know, just basics about around the yard, how to load trucks or cleaning trucks, and then start as a passenger and go into that. So that's for a kid, I think, like if you're getting teenagers or young adults. For adults, I'm not too sure. But even if it was just a 6-month program, just where they kind of get filtered through the process, maybe that could be a bit of an answer.
Those thoughts from South Australian fuel tank driver Kasharina Smith. And for some states, offering apprenticeships to adults has actually helped. Last year, both Queensland and Tasmania established a heavy vehicle driving apprenticeship. But at the moment, other states and territories are only in proposal phases. So it seems like there is a lot of change on the trucking industry's horizon. We'll have to keep our eye on the highway to see what's ahead.
Demetria Panagiotaris ending that report. And we did have a text come through from Carly. She says she drives her refrigerated truck weekly. She just recently got her license. So fantastic to hear. Thanks very much, Carly. And you can read more of that story online as well. Just head to abc.net.au/rural. It's news time, 1 o'clock.
Have you downloaded the ABC Listen app yet? Well, make sure you tap the heart, make ABC Radio one of your favourites. Hold on. We are one of your favourites, aren't we?
Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.